All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 638 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series number 134. We've made a lot of these. Again, the USMLEs, they just keep expanding in content, so unfortunately, we need to keep covering this material. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, for the last, 24 hours has been having very, very severe abdominal pain. And you're told that this patient was recently diagnosed with malignancy and that the patient has been recently initiated on opioids. And then they tell you that they perform radiographic imaging of the abdomen. And you notice that the person's transverse colon is massively dilated. When you see something like this, I really hope you're going to pick the answer, and they ask you for the diagnosis. I really hope you're picking the answer that talks about a toxic megacolon, right? So the thing is, I know some of you may be like, Divine, what? What are you talking about toxic megacolon with a person that is on opioids? Again, our friends at the MBMEs, they're very smart, right? So they know that everybody has memorized that, toxic megacolon has a very strong association with C. diff colitis, right? So C. diff, right? Whenever you see a person that has C. diff and you notice that, wow, the abdominal pain just takes like a big step up, you want to think about toxic megacolon under those circumstances, right? But there are other people that can certainly get toxic megacolon on the USMLE exams, right? So you want to think of it in the context of a person that for whatever reason may have like ileus, right? They may have like ileus, and that can be superimposed with some kind of infection, right? And then the transverse colon just starts dilating like crazy, right? So in fact, if your transverse colon is more than 6 centimeters in diameter, that's really worrisome for toxic megacolon. Those people have to be watched very, very, very closely, right? They have to be watched very closely. They have to be made MPO, right? And again, if you notice that they are beginning to have signs of bowel ischemia or infarction, then those people are going to need surgery. They're going to need surgery, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? So toxic megacolon, yes, there is the classic C. diff association, but it can also be associated with inflammatory bowel disease, right? It can be associated with situations where your GI tract basically does not move, and then an opportunity is created for a bug to proliferate or for infection or whatever to happen. So just keep that at the back of your mind as you prep for your exams, right? So and sometimes on your exams, again, they can use surrogate names, right? So it's like, hey, in every Anki deck known to mankind, the term toxic megacolon is there. So it's like, hey, why put toxic megacolon when we can put something like inflammatory colonic dilation, right? So that's a term you may see on your exams, inflammatory colonic dilation, right? And I guess since we're talking about things that are mega, things that are big, I think I maybe want to go ahead and just mention a few more mega things that we may see on the USMLE exams, right? So we know that there's this bug known as Trypanosoma cruzii, right? That likes to cause big problems, right? So it can cause a big esophagus. It can cause a person to have achalasia, right? It can cause a big heart. It can cause a person to have a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So it can cause big things, right? Another big thing that you want to think of on your exams, right, is if a person has like a big a big colon, especially like a little child, right? And then they tell you that you do a rectal exam and that causes a profuse stool expression, right? Profuse stool expression. Again, the USMLEs, they are not stupid. They're not going to say, you did a rectal exam and you had a poop splatter. Come on, they're not going to put poop splatter on your exam. That's insane, right? No, what they're going to do is they're going to tell you that, hey, that you did a rectal exam and there was a profuse expression of stool. When you see something like that, you absolutely positively want to think about a person with Hirschsprung's disease, right? Hirschsprung's disease. Now, the thing is, again, our friends at the MBMEs, they know that the word Hirschsprung's is in every Anki deck known to mankind. So what's the alternate term they use for this on the exams? They can use terms like congenital megacolon, right? Congenital megacolon is a term you may find for Hirschsprung's disease on your exams. Or sometimes they will call it colonic aganglionosis. Colonic aganglionosis, right? So again, keep this at the back of your mind as you're preparing for your exams. Again, the USMLEs, that's just one classic pattern, right? Again, if you remember the last podcast I made, and by the way, If you missed my last podcast, you absolutely should listen to it. That podcast is one of these kind of like weird, obscure podcasts, but it's very, very high yield for your exams, right? Especially the recent exams, right? So this is like the stuff that's being taken in 2025, 2026, going forward, right? The USMLEs, there are certain rules and regulations they obey in obfuscating questions to get people down the wrong track, right? So again, if you understand those patterns, then you're going to be able to catch on to what they're trying to do. And it's also going to help guide your studying. So you should definitely listen to episode 637. It's a very, very worthwhile podcast to listen to, right? So again, a common pattern on the USMLEs is, hey, let's take what you know and present a surrogate. I talked about that in 637. Talk about it in a different way, right? So again, kind of like how we've talked about toxic megacolon being the same thing as inflammatory colonic dilation. That's one way you can present it, right? Or Hirschsprung's disease being like a congenital megacolon or colonic aganglionosis, right? These are always that they present these things on exams, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and you're told that this patient, you know, for the last 2 weeks has been having this rash on his upper forearm, right? And it's circular, you know, looks clear, you know, looks pale in the middle, right? And it has like surrounding scale and it's been very itchy, right? And then they ask you which of the following in pathogens is the most likely cause. And then let's say they give you an answer that talks about Microsporum canis. And then they give you an answer that talks about trichophyton tonsurans. And then they give you an answer that talks about epidermal phyton. They give you an answer that talks about Staph aureus. They give you an answer that talks about Strep pyogenes. Which one should you pick on your exams? I'd really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I should pick the answer that talks about trichophyton tonsurans, trichophyton, tonsurans. So what does this person have? So what does this person have? Well, this person has tinea corporis, right? This is one of those fungal dermatophyte infections, right? So the person has tinea corporis. And remember, the USMLE is, again, a classic question pattern that they love on exams is they'll give you multiple correct answers to the same thing, right? So this is why podcasts like my Risk Factors podcast, episode 37, 97, 184, and 239 are super important, right? This is why knowing the epidemiology of certain diseases and disorders is extremely important. Why? Because the thing is, they will give you multiple things that work, and then you have to pick up on the one that is most common, right? So like, for example, we know that these tineas, right? Like tinea corporis, you know, which involves the skin, tinea capitis, which involves the head, right? Or onychomycosis, which involves the nails, right? These can be caused by the trichophyton species, the microsporum species, or the epidermal phyton species, right? So trichophyton, microsporum, or epidermal phyton, right? Trichophyton, microsporum, or epidermal phyton, right? But the most common cause of tinea corporis, very high yield, the most common cause of tinea corporis is going to be your trichophyton species. That's number one. Number two are your microsporum species. Number three are your epidermal phyton species, right? So in this case, we're going to go ahead and pick a trichophyton tonsurans, right? And remember, the way we're going to treat these things, especially if it's tinea corporis, is you can use a topical azole. That is perfectly fine for this. But remember, if it involves your head, tinea capitis, or involves your nails, onychomycosis, again, it's the same most common cause, second most common cause, and third most common cause. But in those circumstances, you cannot use topical agents. You need systemic therapies, you know. You need systemic therapies, right? So you're going to need something that can penetrate keratin. So it can be something like an oral azole, or you can use griseofulvin, or you can use a terbinafine, right? Classically on the USMLE exam, they go after terbinafine or griseofulvin. Although many times they prefer that you use terbinafine over griseofulvin, because griseofulvin is a drug interactor, right? It's a cytochrome P450 inducer. It can cause a bunch of problems, right? But remember, it's a CP450 inducer. What are the other CP450 inducers you need to know for your exams? Well, I'd hope you're saying that, hey, Divine, griseofulvin, right? Carbamazepine, right? Rifampin, right? Barbiturates, right? Phenytoin, right? St. John's wort, herbal supplement a person takes for depressive symptoms, right? All those things can cause a person to, you know, they're cytochrome P450 inducers, right? So they will reduce the half-life of the drugs, of the other drugs the person is taking, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind in your prep for your exams. You know, I don't know why today my brain is really swirling with these alternate names for things, right? So again, please make sure you know your alternate names for disorders. It will really come in very, very clutch on your exams. Come in very, very clutch on your exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? You're told that this is a 32-year-old female and that for the past 18 months, she has been having unprotected sex with her husband, but she is unable to conceive, right? And they tell you that she has a history of multiple abortions in the past that have been treated with dilations and curettages. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? What should you be thinking about? I'm giving you some time to think. I hope you're saying, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like Asherman's syndrome, right? And remember, what's an alternate name you may see on your exams for Asherman's syndrome? Asherman's syndrome, it may be called uterine synechiae, right? So or sometimes they can even call this intrauterine adhesions on your exams. Intrauterine adhesions. So let's talk about the pathophysiology, right? So Asherman's syndrome is going to be a cause of infertility. And typically on your USMLE exams, you're going to see it in people that have had a lot of DNCs, right? Because the thing is, when you're having all these multiple dilations and curettages, you know, probably for like abortions or whatever, one thing that can happen is you can scrape the decidua basalis. The decidua basalis contains the stem cells of the uterus, right? So if you scrape away those stem cells, I don't know how you want the uterus to proliferate, right? So that's going to be a problem with things like pregnancy and menses and things like that, right? So that's going to be Asherman's syndrome, also called intrauterine synechiae, also called intrauterine adhesions. Typically, the way you're going to fix that is you're going to hysteroscopically lyse those adhesions. You're going to hysteroscopically lyse those adhesions to fix the person's problem, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. And then what if they give you a question about a 50-year-old male, and you're told that for the past 6 months, this guy has been having a lot of trouble. You know, they tell you that he has been having a lot of chills, right? That he is, he's very intolerant of cold weather, right? And then you're told that he's also been having marital problems because he has, he has erectile dysfunction, right? And you're told that he has like bladder incontinence and things like that. And then you're also told that this person has like some movement abnormalities, and that he's very, you're told that on physical exam, when his gait is assessed, that he takes a considerable amount of time to rise from a seated position. And when he rises, he feels dizzy upon rising. So he has basically like, feels dizzy upon rising, and they can tell you that, oh, his blood pressure sitting down is like 130 over 85. And then his blood pressure upon rising is like 85 over 65 or something like that. So we're seeing orthostasis. If you put all these things together, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're saying that, Divine, this sounds a lot like multiple system atrophy. Remember, many times this is one of those Parkinson's plus syndromes, right? Sometimes on the exams, though, what's an alternate name you may see? An alternate name you may see on your exams with this is something called Shy-Drager syndrome. Shy-Drager syndrome, right? So when you see something like this, I want you to think of multiple systems atrophy, right? So what's going to be the classic presentation? Well, these people are going to have issues with sweating, right? They have a lot of autonomic problems, and they have what sort of kind of looks like Parkinson's, right? So they'll have like a paucity of sweating, so they're going to struggle to sweat. That's number one. And that thing we also see is orthostatic hypotension, right? Orthostatic hypotension. So they may tell you, again, if the USMLEs want to be kind, they'll say, oh, the person has orthostasis, or they'll give you the values, and then you're supposed to deduce that the person is orthostatic. So like, what exactly will that be? Well, that'll be something along the lines of, ooh, the person in a seated or supine position, the blood pressure is X. And then when they stand, right, so in a supine or seated position, blood pressure is X. And then when they stand, you notice that their systolic blood pressure is some number that is X minus 20 or something like that, right? When you see something like that, so minus 20 or greater, think of a person with orthostasis, right? That's like your systolic blood pressure like drops by like more than 20 millimeters of mercury with changes in position, you know, going from being supine to standing. When you see something like that, think of a person having orthostatic hypotension, right? And also, those people tend to have erectile dysfunction. They tend to have issues with controlling their bladder, right? So when you see something like that, think of a person having Scheidt-Dräger syndrome, which is also called multiple system atrophy. And then our friends at the MBMEs, one thing they love to do is to test prognoses, right? So they can ask you, what is the most likely outcome? The most likely outcome is going to be death within about 6 to 10 years, right? It has a very poor prognosis. Treatment is extremely challenging. There's not really much you can do for these people, unfortunately. So kind of keep that at the back of your mind as you're preparing for your exams, right? So Scheidt-Dräger syndrome, also called a multiple system atrophy. Right now, one thing I just want to say that I think will be helpful to you on your exams is, what are the malignancies that are associated with world calcifications on histology? What are the malignancies that are associated with world calcifications on histology? I'd really hope you're saying divine. It can be mesothelioma, or it can be meningioma, or it can be papillary thyroid cancer, or it can be a serous cyst adenocarcinoma of the ovaries, right? So what am I referring to by world calcifications? So world, not W-O-R-L-D, no. It's W-H-O-R-L-E-D, world, in worlds, right? World calcifications, right? That's going to be a person that has a Samoma buddies. Again, the thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they're beginning to evolve, right? So they know that many people have memorized the terms Samoma buddies. They also know that many people have memorized the term lamellated, right? So L-A-M-E-L-L-A-T-E-D, lamellated calcifications. They know that many people have memorized those. So what do they do these days? They're like, okay, well, maybe let's try a new term, right? So these days, instead of calling it Samoma buddies or lamellated calcifications, they may call it the world calcifications. When you see something like that, think of Samoma buddies, right? Remember, Samoma buddies are sort of four classic malignancies, right? Papillary thyroid cancer. Remember, that's the most common thyroid cancer. Remember, that spreads through lymph nodes. It doesn't spread hematogenously, right? And the biggest risk factor there is going to be exposure to radiation. Number two, mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is also associated with Samoma buddies, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for mesothelioma on the USMLE is going to be asbestos exposure, right? And that typically is associated with hemorrhagic pleural effusions. That also has Samoma buddies. And then number three, don't forget your serous cyst adenocarcinomas of the ovaries, right? Those things are probably one of the most common kinds of epithelial ovarian cancers, right? And they're also associated with Samoma buddies. And then number four, do not forget meningioma, right? Remember, meningioma has very strong associations with, growing around cerebral convexities like your Fox cerebri or your Fox cerebelli, right? And remember, it's more common in women because it expresses estrogen receptors, right? And also, we tend to find it in association with NF2, with neurofibromatosis type 2, NF2, right? NF2 has a strong association with meningiomas, schwannomas, and they can also have ependymomas as well, right? And one other thing I guess I want to say about meningiomas is that on the USMLE exams, they don't only present at cerebral convexities. You may also find them at the cerebellopontine angle. That's very high yield to know for your exams, right? The cerebellopontine angle on the USMLEs, there are two classic things that show up there. Either a meningioma or either a meningioma or a schwannoma. Yes, exactly, a schwannoma, which is also known as an acoustic neuroma, right? So those things tend to be found at the cerebellopontine angle, literally the junction between the cerebellum and the pons, right? That's something that can be very easily visualized on brain imaging. So keep that at the back of your mind as you're prepping for your exams. All right, now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 19-year-old female and she has never had menses, right? And then you're told that a vaginal exam is performed and it ends in a blind pouch, right? And then you also notice that the person has poorly developed pubic and axillary hair. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking of androgen insensitivity syndrome. But again, the USMLEs, they know that everybody and their relatives know about androgen insensitivity syndrome. So what do they do on the USMLEs? One thing they love to do on the USMLEs instead is to write an answer that says a testosterone receptor mutation, or they can put an answer that says a testosterone insensitivity, right? Another way they can also write this thing on your exams is they can call it a testicular feminization syndrome. You're like, Divine, are you serious? Yeah. So let's talk about all the names for androgen insensitivity syndrome, right? So again, on your exams, androgen insensitivity syndrome may be called androgen insensitivity syndrome. That's the easy one. Or they can call this testosterone receptor defect, right? They can call this testosterone insensitivity, right? Or they can call this testicular feminization syndrome. Those are all names for the exact same thing on the USMLE exams, right? But again, basically the problem here is that the testosterone receptor does not work. And if the testosterone receptor does not work, you're going to get in a lot of trouble, right? Because again, basically you will not you will not respond to testosterone embryologically, right? So many of the members of your Wolfian duct are going to get degraded, right? But the person genotypically is going to be 46XY, but phenotypically they're going to be female, right? And they will have poorly developed pubic and axillary hair because, again, testosterone controls those things. But they will have well-developed breasts because estrogen controls those things, right? So keep that at the back of your mind as you're preparing for your exams. Keep that at the back of your mind as you're preparing for your exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and you're told that this patient, comes in for the last, 3 days, has been having severe significant shortness of breath, and they tell you that you hear crackles on pulmonary examination, and the person has, 3+ edema of the bilateral lower extremities, and you're told that this person, chest radiography shows a cardiomegaly, and you're told that, medical history is significant for asthma and COPD, and then you're told that the person has previously had respiratory failure requiring intubation when they were given trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? And then they ask you, what's the most appropriate next best step in management? I would really hope you pick the answer that talks about the administration of ethacrynic acid. You're like, what? Ethacrynic acid? Divine, where did that come from? Okay, so let's unpack this, right? Again, remember, mechanisms over memorization, and the USMLEs, they're very, very big. They're very, very big on integration, right? So this person clearly has a CHF exacerbation, right? And then I give this extra history that, hey, this person has a history of a respiratory failure requiring intubation when they got trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole for some infection. That's kind of like anaphylaxis, right? So this person has anaphylaxis with sulfur drugs. So I would really hope that you don't pick the answer that talks about furosemide for this person, right? Again, remember, when a person has an acute CHF exacerbation, typically you're going to give them a loop diuretic. Well, the thing is, loop diuretics are associated with sulfur allergies, right? So if you have a history of a really nasty sulfur allergy like this person clearly has, it will be very unwise to give that person a furosemide. And I can promise you, our friends at the MBMs, they'll put furosemide as an answer. Well, don't pick that, right? Pick the answer that talks about ethacrynic acid. If you want loop diuretic function in a person that has sulfur allergies, then it is not necessarily a bad idea to consider ethacrynic acid. Ethacrynic acid is a loop diuretic, but it's not associated with sulfur allergies. So if you want a loop diuretic effect without the sulfur allergy to boot, consider getting ethacrynic acid, right? Now, one other classic exam scenario you may see, although I guess before I jump to that scenario, let me just talk about this. Ethacrynic acid, though, remember, there is a very good reason why you don't see it commonly used in the hospital. Why? Because of all the loop diuretics, it is the most ototoxic of all, right? It is the most ototoxic of all the common loop diuretics you see tested on the USMLE exams, right? So keep that at the back of your mind as you prep for your test. And what are the other ototoxic drugs that you may see on your test? Well, don't forget vancomycin, right? Don't forget your platinum drugs like cisplatin. Don't forget your aminoglycosides like gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, streptomycin, right? Those things are also ototoxic, right? And then the thing I wanted to jump to is like, hey, what are situations where, if something is associated with sulfur allergy, try something else? Well, again, the classic situation is going to be a person that, again, you need loop diuretic effect. The person has had like a really bad anaphylaxis to a sulfur drug, right? So you don't do furosemide, you do ethacrynic acid. But another classic situation they love to test on the exams is like the difference between a sulfonylurea and a meglitinide, right? So remember, your sulfonylureas are going to be drugs like gliburide, glipizide, glimepiride. We use them to control diabetes. But another drug class that works just like the sulfonylureas are your meglitinides. It is spelled M-E-G-L-I-N-I-T. So Meglitinite. So Meglitinides, right? Meglitinides, your meglitinites. These include drugs like repaglinide and nateglinide, right? They work identically to sulfonylureas, but they have certain benefits. If you have sulfur allergies, well, take a meglitinide instead of a sulfonylurea. That's number one. Number two, these drugs, they are more rapid acting than the sulfonylureas, right? So if you're trying to avoid the dangerous hypoglycemia that you may sometimes get with sulfonylureas, your meglitinides are not a terrible idea under those circumstances, right? So please keep that at the back of your mind as you prepare for your test, as you prepare for your test. Okay, so this is supposed to be a rapid review series, so I think I'm going to go ahead and call it here. But honestly, thank you for joining me today. If you love the way I teach, you love the way I explain mechanisms, you love the way I emphasize mechanisms over memorization, you love the way I make integrations, you're going to love my classes, right? So starting on the 16th of this month, I do have a bunch of classes. I have for step one to step three, I have a 2.5 hour test taking class, a 4 hour biostatistics class, and a 5 hour social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems, and ethics class. And then for step two and three specifically, I have a 20-hour course that is 5 days, 4 hours each day. I have a last-minute review that's 3 hours long. And then in the month of June, the first 2 weeks of June, I have like my motherload course, right? It's a 50-hour step two, step three class, extremely comprehensive, extremely detailed, just an amazing, amazing, amazing class. Very limited spots available for that. If you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. And then in the second week of May, between the 11th to the 15th of May, actually, I have a 25-hour step one class, right? Very good for people studying for step one or level one, or people studying for step two or step three, level two, level three, that have very poor basic science foundations. Because believe it or not, a lot of basic sciences have started showing up on step two and step three. So I think many people do actually benefit from that class. Many people end up taking it in tandem. So they take the 20-hour step two, step three class and also find it very beneficial to take the step one class actually. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email. It's not some teaching assistant or some tutor I employ that teaches these classes. No, it's literally me. So it's me, Divine, that will be teaching, and it's me, Divine, that will be answering your questions, right? The classes are over Zoom. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And I help with mock interviews, personal statements, you know, editing and all those things. So if you're interested in any of those things, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. And I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So check those out. I put all the podcasts on divineinterventionpodcast.com, right? And also every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. But that's on a separate website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. I'm a Christian, right? So I make these podcasts and actually many people find them to be very helpful. I have like almost 400 podcasts on there. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 639. But share this with your friends, with your colleagues. Again, I'm sure they're going to find this to be super, super helpful. Well, until next time, have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.